This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour this Friday, May 3rd, 2024. This is the Week in Review edition of our show, and this show is what we sometimes call the voice of the Philadelphia Trumpet Magazine. You can find out about the Trumpet at thetrumpet.com, where you'll find frequent updates, daily updates of the news, and then we gather the best of the best from the week and give it to you here in this Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour on KPCG. I'm Philip Nice with our Philadelphia Trumpet writers Jeremiah Jacques, Richard Palmer, and Mihailo Zekic. Andrew Miller is not in studio today. He's unable to be with us. Among other things, among chemistry equations and ancient Irish genealogies and historical economic tables and Supreme Court cases and other related and unrelated topics and roles, Andrew Miller watches the Anglo-America region. He has still been on the job this week. He's been watching it this week and provided some notes that I think I'll just provide to you. Surely everyone's been watching the developments on college campuses this week. He mentions that, and how can you escape seeing just absolute chaos on some of the top campuses in America and all over support, actual support for Hamas terrorists, an attempt through protests and demonstrations to save Hamas from being destroyed by the Israel Defense Forces. That's been dominating the news as Americans kind of sit back and think, what has happened to American education? I remember Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury talking about education. And we've talked, I think even last week, we talked a little bit about what education is and the fact that you can have false education, you can have wrong education. And I think we're seeing that borne out in an inescapable way through these headlines. You're seeing this chaos, you're seeing on college campuses. Meanwhile, what you might not have heard about is the first bank failure of 2024, and that was Republic First Bank out of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and it was shut down by Pennsylvania's bank regulator, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation seized its assets. The reason this is significant is not only for people interested in banking in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, but because it echoes 2023 and the bank failures of First Republic Bank, not to be confused with Republic First Bank, Silicon Valley Bank, and others that could easily have been the first dominoes to fall in a major 2008-style banking crisis. That didn't happen, or it hasn't happened yet, but as Andrew Miller mentioned in a video that we recorded yesterday, hopefully we'll post today, as these small banks fail, there are consequences as their assets get absorbed more and more so into the large banks, which gives those large banks, you know, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, more and more power. And if the leadership of just a few of those banks, rather than many, many, many banks across the country, want to go woke, as they say, or something like that, then there are no other options. If you're monitoring power, then you'll notice a flow of power from individuals, from, you know, smaller banks, many, many smaller banks, toward the hands of a few. And another thing you might not have noticed is a group of 18 Democrat senators reintroduced a bill to legalize marijuana nationwide. We have been talking a bit about the effects of marijuana legalization here in Oklahoma, working on a video of that as well that you can see at thetrumpet.com probably next week. And the effects have been dramatic, even leaving actual effects of drugs on someone's brain and mind and life and family and so forth. Land sales in Oklahoma are going more and more to foreign entities, specifically Chinese. And so it has been the case that state inspectors will drive up to a property and say, hey, we need to inspect what's happening here. And they'll be met by men with rifles. And they're not from around here, as we might say in Oklahoma, then the state inspector will be deterred from inspecting that property. We also know, of course, of the murder scene not far from here in Kingfisher, where something terrible went down within a gang or foreign-operated illegal enterprise that resulted in murders. You can read about that on thetrumpet.com and in the latest issue of The Trumpet. If you haven't subscribed to The Trumpet print edition, it comes free of charge. Never will you even be asked for a contribution 10 times a year. And we're working on the next issue right now. So get your subscription before we send that out. And I think that'll be the first issue that you receive.
Can I hop in with a positive spin on one of those stories?
Which one?
The campus protests.
Yeah, well, let's hear it.
Yeah, well, I just thought this was funny. Did you see the story about the Phi Kappa Phi guys? You had this story where the protesters wanted to tear down the American flag. I think they're planning on destroying it. And you had these frat boys coming out and rallying around and defending the flag. So the picture of them holding up this U.S. flag, preventing
enormous
it from touching
American
the ground.
Flag. Yes, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it goes viral. But what I loved was then somebody went and started a GoFundMe page for them. So they said, yeah, we all love this. Let's have a GoFundMe page so we can all throw in a bit of money and let them have a big party. I like their writing on their Go. They said yes. This was for these triumphant bohemians protecting old glory from the unwashed Marxist hordes. Help us raise funds to throw this frat the party they deserve, a party worthy of the boat-shoed proletariat who did their country proud. Anyway, it shut down, I think, this morning or last night after having raised $500,000.
Right.
So I enjoyed that story. I thought it's nice to see a nation rallying around the flag. I also thought it did make an important point, though, and it's the same point that Lee Smith made in just an absolutely fabulous article he published at The Tablet, a much less positive one, I have to say. But that is that, like, what is going on with Israel and with Hamas, like, it's an assault on traditional American values. Like, that's what Hamas's assault on Israel is about. That's why these protesters are pro-Hamas. Like, I don't think it was satire. It might have been, but I saw another video today of some Muslim preacher saying, well, the reason why Gaza is not winning is because there are too many homosexuals in the pro-Hamas protests, and Allah is not going to bless a movement that has all of these homosexuals involved in it. Like, it is bizarre seeing the radical left come out in favor of what's going on, but the connection is that it is all anti-Western values. This is why Joe Biden and Barack Obama are kind of closet supporters of Hamas, or not so closet supporters of Hamas. And they are coming out and really trying to hold back Netanyahu completely. I mean, they couch it in nice sounding words, but it's a complete change to America's traditional policy to try and really harm Israel and help Hamas. And it's because they hate those traditional values. And that's why you have a story like this, where the entire nation kind of rallies around this group of frat boys. Because it's this kind of intersection where it's American values that are under attack. You look at the pictures and it's a bunch of white men. You know, this is the people that we've been told to hate. This is everything that's wrong with the world. But it's all about these traditional values. So I just thought that was a bit of a fun way of making that point, that this is not, for so many people, about what's going on in the Middle East. It's about fundamentally transforming the United States and Western civilization as well.
That's a good point. I like how you connected that to the Tablet article by Lee Smith, and that'll fit with what Andrew has in his outline. In your outline, your daily news update that you send to some of us, I really appreciated how you brought that out. And when Americans across the nation give frat boys $500,000 to party, to throw a party, it's kind of a fun little news item, like you said, but it is significant. It's showing like a desperation for some way to fight back, some way to show support, some way to say, we are not doing this, right? And I don't know anything about those frat boys, but I'm going to send them $1,000 for them to waste, or I don't know what they're going to do with it, but to show my support for that flag and the good things that that flag has waved over. It has definitely waved over, you know, bad things as well. This country is not perfect, but people are desperate. They had the Palestinian flag on that flagpole, and those boys helped pull it down and just put up the American flag. And we are so desperate at this point for just some sense of sanity, some sense of good, that if boys will raise a flag against opposition, we will support that. So that is an interesting story and an indicative story, and significant for that reason. You mentioned former President Barack Obama and current White House occupant Joe Biden. Andrew, actually, for his main story, he has in the outline here something that's interesting. I'll just kind of read a bit of this. He says, former President Obama and alumnus of Columbia University, which is where a lot of these protests have taken place, is staying silent on the violent anti-Semitic rhetoric aimed at Jewish students. But here's what's interesting. His staffers are not. More than 250 former staffers in the Obama administration and campaign workers sent a letter to their former bosses on Tuesday demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and calling for the U.S. to end its support for Israel. So even the support that Israel is receiving from the United States, too much for these people who are openly calling for that to end. Obama and Biden themselves being a little more cagey about it, it seems. We're monitoring this very closely because, as we talked about in our trumpet meeting earlier this week, we are looking very closely for this, how this relationship between the United States and Israel, which has been completely dependent strategically on the United States, is going to work out. This brotherhood, these are brother nations, as we've mentioned before, as United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong explains. There's a brotherhood there. It has broken in the past. The Bible records that. It's going to break in the future as well. And when Israel doesn't have the United States supporting it, when the next generation of American leaders are openly hating Jewish students and Jews and certainly the Jewish nation, then Israel is going to look elsewhere for support. And we've got quite a bit on that at thetrumpet.com. You can look at United States and Britain Prophecy, as I mentioned, and also this article, Betraying Israel in Its Hour of Need, a good summary of this trend that we're watching for, that's betraying Israel in its hour of need. So, Andrew, if and when you're listening, we hope you get better and you'll be back with us next week. And thank you for providing us that week in review for the Anglo-America section. Now let's go to the Asia region. Jeremiah Jacques, give us a rundown of the top stories from Asia before we get to the main topic you want to focus on.
Made in China. Those are three words that many people around the world have probably seen around their homes. America and many other nations have outsourced our manufacturing to China for decades now. And all kinds of products stamped with those three words, made in China, fill our homes and our businesses too. Well, this week, there was a Taiwanese woman who has a made in China security camera in her home. And she happened to be perusing one of China's social media platforms, and she suddenly saw footage taken by her private security camera in her home that had been uploaded to this social media platform. This was footage of the recent earthquake that hit Taiwan. And this woman had never shared the footage with anyone. She'd never uploaded or sent it anywhere. But the Chinese company that made this camera had installed a capability to remotely access her private footage. And someone in China was apparently illegally watching that footage and decided to post some of it on social media. So this may seem like kind of a small story, but if you think about all of the security cameras in the world, you know, and how many of those are stamped with those three words, made in China, and think about the ability of China to blackmail certain people, to learn the comings and goings of certain important people, to study the vulnerability of certain facilities around the world, or you know, things like that, then you see that this has all kinds of chilling implications, even implications related to national security. Now, because of these security concerns, the U.S. government has already banned Chinese-made cameras from two different manufacturers, Hikvision and Dahao manufacturers. But who knows which other Chinese manufacturers may have secretly built in kind of a backdoor for remote access to their cameras. So it's just one more area where we can see that the decision to outsource our manufacturing to China, yes, it saved us some money.
Right.
Yes, we can buy a lot of products very inexpensively, but that decision to outsource comes at a great cost.
It's come up already as well. I don't know whether you saw last year Anker. I mean, they're a big brand. They have EUFY, I don't know how you say it, EUFY cameras. There was a big scandal where they promised consumers end-to-end encryption, not share or whatever. Turned out that they'd lied. It wasn't end-to-end encryption, and there was ways to access this footage. It was even getting posted online. I can't remember all of the details, but it was a massive thing for them. And they're one of like the top consumer. If you're an individual and you want to buy a cheap security camera for your home, they're one of the top brands. Stories like that make you wonder, okay, well, is this unencrypted? Is it not a bug, but a feature? Like, how much of it is it deliberately even that way rather than, oh, we messed up as a company?
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's very chilling to think about the just the implications of this. Then another story here about Georgia, not the state that's close to those fraternity members that Mr. Palmer discussed a moment ago, but the Republic of Georgia. We spoke a few weeks ago about a new law that some of Georgia's pro-Russia politicians were trying to pass. This is called the Foreign Influence Bill, and critics say that Russia is pushing it just in order to tighten its grip on Georgia. Well, the law is now being debated in the Georgian parliament, and it is expected to pass. And since the overwhelming majority of Georgia's people oppose this law, they've taken to the streets to protest. Reports say that hundreds of thousands have been demonstrating over the last several days because they want their nation to align with Europe instead of Russia. And this law is a step in the wrong direction. So we'll see what happens when this bill is sent to the president and as Russia works to pressure the various politicians. Since some 80% of Georgians want to align with Europe, these mass protests that we're seeing really should be no surprise.
So go ahead and hit us with that main story. I thought this is the one that should lead the program this week. Go ahead and explain that to us.
Sure. Today is day 800 of Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine, this war that is aimed at conquering the territory and the people of Ukraine. And what we're seeing this week and last week as well is some real urgency and determination on the part of the Russians. They know very well that the United States has, after many months of refusing to assist Ukraine, the U.S. has now approved another substantial aid package to help Ukraine defend themselves. And so Russia knows that new weapons and ammo are coming, and they're trying to push all they can right now before the new weapons and ammo arrive on the front lines. So Russia's been pushing with serious force in the Donetsk region, especially. They've committed three different critical brigades to one Donetsk area. That's the 30th, the 35th, and the 74th Brigade. And Russia has apparently lost just a stunning number of soldiers in this push, just throwing them into the meat grinder. But the strategy has delivered some gains for Russia. They've captured three villages in the area, and this is bringing Russia closer to an area called Chasiv Yar, which has been a big goal for the Russians for some time now. If Russia can take Chasiv Yar, they would have some high ground that could potentially enable them to oust the Ukrainians from some areas that are critical to Ukraine's defensive line. And then from there, there could be a meaningful breakthrough for the Russians. So, you know, at present, these Russian gains are very modest. We're talking about three small settlements and just a few square miles of land near Krasnorivka, and then a few more square miles in some nearby pockets. So, you know, it is surprising that the world's second most powerful military, even after 800 days of full-scale war, is still only making these kinds of very incremental and very high-cost gains. But this development is significant, because there does look to be some real pressure building here. And if it goes as Russia hopes, before the new weaponry can get into the hands of the Ukrainians, then we might see a more significant breakthrough for Russia soon.
Ukraine's 5th Assault Brigade has referred to Chasiv Yar as the door to the rest of Donetsk Oblast. When you control Chasiv Yar, you control the most dominant elevation in the area and highways, leading to the so-called fortress cities of Donbass. These cities are the last stronghold of the Donetsk region, which is under the control of Ukraine. This is the dominant height in the region, and its control will allow the Russian invaders, if they achieve it, to significantly simplify the advance in the direction of Konstantinivka and the direction of Slovyansk and Kramatorsk.
That was Devin Drake with the Kings and Generals YouTube channel there, just explaining how strategically important Chasiv Yar is and how this could lead to some sort of potentially significant breakthrough for Russia. So it's easy to see why the Russians are pushing so hard right now, just hoping to punch through Ukraine's defenses before Ukraine is rearmed and reestablished. And this means that there's a lot for us to keep a close eye on there.
I'm no expert, no strategic mind on warfare and so forth, but just the will of Russia to spend thousands of lives, to spend 800 days, and to show that whatever happens, the will of the Russian people, more accurately, the will of Russian President Vladimir Putin, will not break. So that's, I think, something that continues to prove to be the case, that one side of this has the will to spend blood, to spend treasure. And at this point, would anything break his will? I just think that this really shows the power of a will that's not something to be praised, but it is strong, and it is something that's willing to spend human life like crazy on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side. He's not going to back down. So now what? You know, you have that on the one side. On the other side, you have the Western world, and you have, you know, United States money and assets and so forth. You have a resilient, let's say, Ukrainian resistance, and the strong will of that one man makes up for so much, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned Putin's will, because that really factors heavily into the equation here. The trumpet, you know, we've been saying since the start of the war, 800 days ago, that Russia will most likely win it. And we've maintained that whatever happens, Putin will remain in power and actually become even more powerful. That has been our stance, because Ezekiel chapter 38 talks about a man in the modern era. And the New King James Version of the Bible describes this man as, quote, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot over the years about this man. And he says that Rosh, in that passage, should be viewed as a variation of the name Russia. And he says the other two names signify the Russian cities of Moscow in the west and Tobolsk more toward the east. In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury says it's clear to him that this is describing Vladimir Putin. And he says the way this is written, with those, you know, different names for different parts of Russia, it shows that Putin would go on to conquer more of the former Soviet territory. He writes, the use of all three names, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, shows that this is an individual ruler of all the peoples of Russia from the west to the east. The reference to the cities of Moscow and Tobolsk helps us to see how vast Russian territory is in these latter days. This giant swath of land indicates the prince will probably conquer more nations of the former Soviet Union. End quote. That booklet was written back in 2017, well before Russia's current full-scale invasion of the former Soviet nation of Ukraine. And now we see that Russia is making gains that are, you know, yes, they are incremental, and yes, they're coming at an extremely high cost to Russia, but they could lead to a breakthrough soon. And if any listener would like to understand the details of that, I hope they'll order a free copy of that booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
That's The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And in that title, Prince of Russia is in quotes. And there's a very specific reason why Prince of Russia is in quotes. It's very significant. You can get that at thetrumpet.com/library. Jeremiah, you're writing on Asia, as you always do, for the Philadelphia Trumpet print magazine, which I am exhorting our listeners to order a free subscription to. Hitting it deadlines like a champ, I might add.
Thank you.
What's the Asia story you're working on for the print edition?
The one that I think will be in this current issue is, the working title is Not Just for Land. And it talks about how Russia's conquests are motivated not just by a desire to claim territory, but also the people that live in that territory. Russia is in a demographic death spiral. Their people have stopped reproducing at rates that would even begin to sustain the population, so they're shrinking. So the article just sort of zeroes in on how a big part of the conquest of Ukraine, and also Belarus and Georgia and Moldova and Chechnya back in the 90s, a big part of the calculus for that is that Russia wants more people. That way, it'll have enough soldiers for future wars.
One of the largest mass kidnappings, if I can characterize it that way, in history, I would think, having read your draft on that. Another dimension of this war, and probably another reason for Putin's calculus and Putin's strong will to basically now or never, with as far as the greatness of Russia, the resurgence of Russia, the reversal of that catastrophe of the fall of the Soviet Union as he looks at it. So that'll be in the next Philadelphia Trumpet print edition. Look for that, and look for Jeremiah Jacques' byline. That's Anglo-America this week. That's Asia this week on the Week in Review edition of Trumpet Hour. Stay with us here on KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Hello and welcome back to KPCG, Trumpet Hour, and the Week in Review edition of the show. We've covered Anglo-America as well as Asia, and our third region is the Middle East. Mihailo Zekić joins us from our studio in Edstone, England. Mihailo, what's the main news out of the Middle East?
Well, a small African country is allowing Russian troops to set up shop inside an American military base, and Washington is doing nothing about it. That is the news coming out from everyone's favorite country in the Sahel, Niger, or Niger, as most of my colleagues would pronounce it. We talked about how the United States is withdrawing troops, roughly 1,000 soldiers from the country at the urging of the junta there. Well, we found out what's replacing them. Anonymous defense officials told Reuters on an article published yesterday that Russian military personnel have entered an airbase that is being used by the United States military next to the international airport at the capital of the country. And never mind the fact that this little country that's impoverished, that those 1,000 troops could probably solve that own junta in an instant if they ever decided to do that. This little country is doing this to an American military base, but look at what the United States' response is. The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was asked about the Reuters report, and in a press conference in Honolulu, this is the excuse he gave. Quote, "The Russians are in a separate compound and don't have access to U.S. forces or access to our equipment," end quote. I mean, Russia's one of the most skilled countries in espionage in the world. Like, and that's all you could say is, well, technically, they're in a different building from us in the compound, so we're safe. We're good to go. I mean, come on. If that was not a blatant showing one's hand on how all these chaotic events in the Middle East, they're not just incompetence. They're willfully letting America's enemies trample on American soldiers, on America's prestige, to the point where it's unnecessarily embarrassing. There you go. Moving on to the war in Israel, that's been a country that's attacking Israel in a new way, and that is Turkey. On Wednesday, Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan said that Turkey would join in South Africa's genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice, making it the second country to tag along at the bandwagon. Later, Turkey also announced that they're going to halt all trade with Israel to the point where there are goods in ports in Turkey that were supposed to leave for Israel that are stopped from being put onto the ships, and Israeli goods in those same ports that the government is stopping from being unloaded. It's that sudden. And this might not sound like a big deal. Turkish-Israeli trade is worth about $7 billion a year. Turkey is one of the few Muslim countries, or countries in the Middle East in general, that recognize Israel. So, and for most of the history of those two countries being countries, the relations have been pretty cordial. So this is going to sting quite a bit. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, we've talked about him a lot on this show. He's a notorious flip-flopper, making friends with his partners in the region, all of a sudden to do reverse course and turn back unnecessarily. He's done this with Israel quite a bit, but when he's taking Israel to the court for genocide, I honestly do not see how he could possibly save face at a future moment and have relations restored, whether it's with Prime Minister Netanyahu or any other Israeli leader. Turkey, obviously, is a country that features quite heavily in Bible prophecy, especially in its, shall we say, cruel attacks against the nations of Israel, crueler than some other countries even will happen. So this might be a sign of that to come, or it might be a sign that we could expect somebody else in Turkey to launch what we would call a prophesied betrayal, because, I mean, to betray somebody, you have to trust them in the first hand, and nobody trusts Erdogan right now, but the Israelis especially don't trust him. But either way, it's a bit of a wrinkle in the situation in the Middle East that we'll keep watching.
We talked about the divisions in America and American universities in particular this week earlier, and the issue there, the spark, has been Israel. Not love for Muslims or Palestinians or Hamas, but hatred for Israel. Now, Turkey, a very important nation in that region and beyond, attacking economically, diplomatically, and Israel finding itself just absolutely surrounded by enemies that are now taking important actions against it your main story from the Middle East also concerns Israel. How could it not?
Yes, it involves a new terror group that has joined the foray and declared war on Israel, and that is the Al-Ashtar Brigades. Now, for those of you that haven't heard of them before, you might be thinking, oh, it's another terror group I'm not familiar with that starts with Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab. Like, ooh, how does this impact me? What's important about this? The reason why this is important is the country they're actually from. They're a Bahraini Shiite militia. And the attack itself looks like it was pretty minor. They basically declared war and they uploaded a video of them sending a drone, which they claimed successfully hit a trucking company all the way in Eilat, that Israeli port on the Red Sea. That particular trucking company they refer to has been doing a lot of business with the United Arab Emirates, which is, of course, along with Bahrain, one of the few Gulf Arab states that did open up relations with Israel in recent days and has been getting a lot of flack from the rest of the Muslim world for doing so. The Israeli side, for their part, hasn't been confirming or denying, at least last time I checked, that this has happened. So there are a few unknowns there. From what analysts can tell from the drone they saw in the video, it actually looks similar to some of the drones the Houthis have been sending from Yemen towards Israel. So people are wondering, how could a terror group in Bahrain send a drone so far away? I mean, the Houthis have been able to do it. It's roughly a comparable distance. And for those that aren't familiar, Bahrain is a tiny island, an Arab country in the Persian Gulf there near Qatar, near Iran. So it is pretty far away, but it wouldn't be too far away for some of these other groups. And the reason, again, why this is so important is because it's in Bahrain. We've talked a lot on this program before about attacks coming from Yemen, the Houthis and their quasi-state, they don't like Israel, or attacks coming from Iraq. The Iraqi militias, they don't like Israel too, and the Iraqi government's too weak to stop them. Bahrain is probably one of Israel's biggest friends in the Middle East, which is why they started up relations long ago. Now, it's been a few years now. They're also one of America's biggest friends in the region. They're a major non-NATO ally. That's a specific designation, meaning they have access to U.S. intelligence. A lot of other countries don't, including Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, some of these other countries that America has partnerships with. America has a huge naval base in Bahrain. It's sort of almost one of the command centers of American operations in that side of the Middle East. And most importantly, Bahrain is probably the country single most afraid of Iran. This terror war that Israel is involved in, as we've talked about so many times, it's really a war from Iran against Israel. Hamas is an Iranian proxy. Hezbollah is an Iranian proxy. The Houthis are an Iranian proxy. Bahrain is a bit unique because its brand of Islam is Shia Islam, and it mainly targets other Shia groups. Bahrain is a Sunni monarchy ruling over a Shiite population. And when the Arab Spring was happening, there was some unrest in Bahrain like there wasn't the rest of the Arab world. But a lot of that unrest was tied to people wanting an Iranian-style Islamic revolution, like holding up pictures of the first Ayatollah and that kind of thing. And, of course, Bahrain is also just a short boat ride away from Iran, too. So, which is the big reason why the government of Bahrain is trying to pursue relations with Israel and with the United States so much, because they know their hold on power in that country, where Iran has a natural, shall we say, ability to exert influence compared to even a lot of other Arab countries, is really, really tenuous.
I condemn Hamas unequivocally. This is so everybody in the room can understand that I stand on the side of civilians and innocence and not on the side of political posturing. The attacks on October 7th were barbaric, they were horrific, they were indiscriminate, they killed women, children, elderly, did not matter. They hit civilian institutions and they hit military targets. And on top of that, it seems it's okay now to grab hostages and take them away and speak about it as if it's an act of war. That is something that we condemn. And we condemned it on October the 9th, I believe, or 8th. Now, Israel. I unequivocally condemn the air campaign that resulted in the death of over 11,000 people in Gaza, 4,700 of which are children. Now, both of these actions have led to the death of innocents. Both of these actions did not save the entirety of mankind, and in effect are the equivalent of killing all of mankind.
That was a clip from last November at a conference by Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa, who is the crown prince of Bahrain there. You can see, listen to there, he speaks pretty good English. And I think this is a good clip on just to goes to show how much this war with Iran is making them nervous. You notice that he spent about a minute in that clip condemning Hamas. And then he spent about 15 seconds condemning Israel. And then he talked about how both sides are to like bother. And an Arab leader to spend the lion's share of his time condemning Hamas and all the atrocities on October 7th. And then as a token mention Israel, so that way his people don't stage a revolution against him and he doesn't lose all legitimacy in the Arab world. That shows you how much they're afraid of Iran. And it's one thing for Hamas and some of these other foreign groups to be involved with. When it's in a Bahraini group itself, when it's a Bahraini group, never mind that it's attacking Israel, it's declared a terrorist group by Bahrain itself and the Saudis and some of these other figures in the region. Like, this is basically Iran's terror war if the Al-Ashtar brigades are taking this declaration seriously and are going to be ramping up their attacks and are going to be playing a serious role in this. This is basically bringing the war home to Bahrain. And if you're a tiny country that has such a tenuous grip on power that's already terrified by Iran, what does that mean for you? Like, the Bahrainis are probably terrified right now, and they're probably going to be looking for allies, strengthening their alliance with Israel, but also looking for other allies to put a stop to Iran. It's not just Israel's war now. This is what this means. It's an out-in-the-open declaration that this is Bahrain's war, too. This is a Saudi's war, too. This is a war by Iran on the moderate Arabs as well. And more, they're being more brazen about it. And more, you're going to see these moderate Arabs be more open about their responses as well.
So why do you think that? What leads you to think that? And what are you firm on as far as what we're going to see in the future?
Well, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, last week, we released a Key of David television episode describing just that. Specifically, it details a prophecy in the Book of Psalms, specifically Psalm 87, which speaks of a conglomeration of nations that are banding together to that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And it mentions a bunch of names that are found in the Bible, like Edom, like the Ishmaelites, Asher, etc. And biblical and secular history shows that, A, no alliance of these particular peoples has ever come together, and never for this particular purpose. Because of that, our editor-in-chief has pointed to this being an end-time prophecy, and that the modern descendants of these peoples is what it's referring to. In this case, specifically the Ishmaelites, I mean, that's an easy one. That's what we would call the peninsular Arabs, including Bahrain, including the Saudis. I mean, they even themselves trace their ancestry through Muslim tradition back to Ishmael. In that Key of David episode, and this is not the first place he's talked about this, but Mr. Fleury said that one of the reasons, or at least implied that one of the reasons this group comes together is also fear of Iran. And these countries are going to band together and they're going to look for somebody to protect them from Iran. Specifically, he pointed to Germany, which is also mentioned in that prophecy under the prophetic name Asher. These countries have been afraid of Iran for a very long time. But with everything that's going on, like this new declaration from the Al-Ashtar brigades, like the big terror attack that Iran launched from its own soil that we talked about a few weeks ago on this program, and everything else we talked about on this program, the Saudi nuclear program, that's related to this as well. More and more, these modern Arab countries, you could see them getting more desperate, saying things that they normally would never say, making partnerships that they normally would never make. They see how powerful Iran is. They see how much sway Iran has over all these terror groups on all sides of the Middle East. And again, how the Bahraini government will respond to this latest declaration, we'll see. But they want Iran stopped, and they want somebody to do it. They know they can't do it by themselves. We've talked about in this program again about how Germany's been getting into the Middle East and how Germany is looking more and more like Israel, one of Israel's closest allies, and what some groups like Hezbollah, a country that they're afraid to tackle with. I'm sure Bahrain and some of these other countries see that as well. And going forward, you can expect more and more German involvement with these countries as these countries get more desperate with Iran. And if our listeners would like to learn more, our editor-in-chief has written a pretty sizable book all about Iran and the Arab modern Arab countries and Germany and a lot more else called The King of the South. You can get a free copy at thetrumpet.com.
That's The King of the South by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory. So we've offered you The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and Betraying Israel in Its Hour of Need there at thetrumpet.com. And now this King of the South by Gerald Flory and the Key of David episode by Mr. Flory titled Psalm 83. And it's got the German Bundestag on the cover image there, and there's a strong reason for that. So does the Bible, do the Psalms of all things, a book of songs in the Bible, actually talk about 21st century nations? Is there specifics? Does it give you specifics? Is that something you can actually compare to the news? Is there something you can know for sure? Is there something you could actually do about it? Is that why it's in the Bible? I would recommend Psalm 83, that Key of David episode at thetrumpet.com as a great starting point, and then The King of the South by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory. For our last region, we go over to Europe. Mr. Palmer, what's the news from Europe?
Well, starting with some from the UK, Hasma Yousef made himself famous as Scotland's first minister with his clampdown on free speech. He's probably best known abroad for that, trying to restrict what Scots can say, even in the freedom of their own home, kind of criminalizing kitchen table discussion, but also for a speech in which he complained that everyone in public life in Scotland is white, or the head of at least a large list of different places is white. It shouldn't be surprising, given that Scotland is 96% white, but he was very upset about this. And because of that video, became the most complained about person for hate crime under Scotland's hate crime law. He is out. He's gone. He went this week. He fell out with his coalition partners, the Green Party. The Scottish National Party exists to make Scotland an independent country. To do that, they rely on revenue from North Sea oil. The Greens don't like that. But also just this shift away from some of the extreme woke policies that he'd embraced, that the Greens embraced. He was trying to step away from that. But once he ended this coalition, the Greens forced him out from office. So he's gone. I think you could call that good news, given some of the damage that he's done. But less good news than in the discussion on who would replace him. One of the favorites to do that was Kate Forbes. She came very close to getting the job instead of Yousef last time there was a vote. She lost out by just a few percentage points. And she's already ruled out running. She came immediately under a huge amount of criticism because she is, in today's terms, a relatively staunch Christian. She opposes homosexual marriage. She's a member of the We Free Church, the Scotland Presbyterian Church, that is known, at least in the media, and all, you know, she's portrayed as, well, hardline views and all of this kind of thing. And there was just all of this negative press to the point that she kind of officially ruled out running. So I think, once again, confirmation that basically you can't be a Christian, even in this kind of this world sense in Britain, in politics. If you believe some, if you're against homosexual marriage or abortion, there is no role for you at the top of politics in Britain. You can be a Muslim who openly sympathizes with Hamas. Yeah, that's fine, but not a Christian. That's too extreme. So that's a sad state of affairs in the British Isles. Another British story, Ireland has been waking up to its migrant problem. You've been having more and more protests. They've been building over several months, but I think it's built to the point that the media can no longer ignore it. Here in Britain, there's a fairly high degree of schadenfreude. Since Brexit, the Irish have cooperated with the EU in weaponizing the Irish border. And, you know, well, we can't have any kind of hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. If that happens, there will be terrorism again. There will be bombs going off in English cities. There cannot be a hard border. And they used this to extract all kinds of concessions from Britain and to keep parts of Britain kind of hostage to the European Union. And now, though, because there's no hard border, Britain is talking about clamping down on migrants. There's talk of sending them to Rwanda. That way, those that kind of claim political asylum, they claim they'd be persecuted back home, or they can go to Rwanda and be safe from that persecution. but also we don't have to take in more people than we can handle in the UK. But Ireland is now complaining that they're being flooded with migrants because anyone that is afraid of being sent to Rwanda can just move to the Republic of Ireland. There's no border. And in fact, after all of this fuss over the border, they're talking about putting up border patrols and putting in place all of the things that 5 minutes ago they were saying would cause a renewed outbreak of terrorism. So I think a lot of that has been exposed as lies, basically, that was used as a convenient excuse by the Republic of Ireland and by the EU to try and punish the UK for Brexit. Moving on to mainland Europe, France and Germany have signed their tank deal. We talked about this a few weeks ago when they agreed the major components of that deal. So they're moving forward to develop a new battle tank. They're working to do that at a European level. We talked last week about Emmanuel Macron's speech about the need to do more at a European level to kind of borrow funds and work together to develop European weapons instead of buying American weapons, to develop a European market that can sell thousands of these models. They're working on that in a practical way. French President Emmanuel Macron gave a really interesting speech where he was basically gave the clearest sign ever that he was open to sharing France's nuclear weapons. He's previously been a little cagey on this, France's nuclear weapons, they're for France anyway. And he said, well, actually, no, we're open to having a discussion to making France's nuclear weapons a European nuclear deterrent. The EU no longer has to rely on the United States for that nuclear deterrent, and says, well, there's a European dimension to this. He says, well, that discussion, that's going to have to, we're going to want something, basically. So if other countries are willing to help us out with long-range defense and anti-missile defense, well, then we're open to a discussion on sharing our nuclear umbrella. So this could be a major step towards France empowering a military EU. That is the subject of the cover article of the latest Trumpet print. That cover, Germany's secret, France's ignorance, is on the cover there. But that talks about that critical relationship. And finally, Greece. Greece is changing their employment law to be a bit more like the US, where they have more freedom to work when you want to work and less restriction on when you can work. Now, Greece is legalizing working 6 days in a week. Previously, that was illegal. Now, that might not sound super newsworthy, but you go back to the Greek financial crisis and they were looking at mandating a 6 day week where you have to work 6 days a week. And also, Greek law already says you cannot work on Sunday. That is very closely guarded. And so for Europe to now, for Greece to allow 6 day week, it's a step in a direction of something that they were considering earlier and were kind of forced to row back on. And this then, you put it in terms of other things happening across Europe, could well be a step in terms of, well, you have to work on Saturday and you have to rest on Sunday. That is a really key trend that we're watching here at the Trumpet, because if this is a specific forecast that you will have Europe as an identifying sign, as a mark, you are forced to accept a key religious value. And that would be the mark of this rising beast power in Europe. So you see a step towards that with what is happening in Greece.
We've said for years at the Philadelphia Trumpet, before I was on staff, that Europe will enforce a 6 day work week, more specifically a rest on Sunday law. And as you said, this law in Greece is not that, but it's very reminiscent of something that we're watching very closely for. And it would take quite a revolution in Europe for this to happen. But the Trumpet says, and has consistently said, that there will be an enforced Sunday observance in Europe. So anything that indicates that, we're going to be watching very closely. But you're watching even more closely the main story. What is this main story out of Europe this week, and why is it the main one?
This ties in very much with what we were just talking about with the Psalm 83 Alliance. But the EU is putting together $1 billion in assistance for Lebanon. They'll be given this billion euros from 2024 to 2027. And this is, it's another migrant bribe. This has become Europe's kind of default way of dealing with migrants. If they get migrants flooding into their country from a particular source, they give that source lots of money to hold it back. So initially it was Turkey. You had tons of migrants flooding into Greece and elsewhere from Turkey. So they paid Turkey a whole bunch of money to stop those migrants from coming across. In this case, very recently, migrants have started arriving from Lebanon into Cyprus. The EU acted very fast to step in there and to offer Lebanon 1 billion euros to stop those migrants. A chunk of that is going to go to the Lebanese armed forces. I think that was about 200 million euros to beef up Lebanon's border. Others will go for kind of migrant relief. And the SAM 83 alliance is precisely why we are watching this. We have an article, it's about 10 years old now, from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, called Why You Need to Watch Lebanon. And he makes the point that you've got this prophecy in Psalm 83 that talks about Europe developing a relationship with various different states across the Middle East. And there are biblical names for all of these countries listed there. Turkey is included in that. But Lebanon stands out as having uniquely a large Christian population. Not a majority, but kind of in the realms of somewhere around 20-30%. About a third of the country is Christian. And so Mr. Fleury wrote, the heavy Christian population makes Lebanon different from the rest of the Arab world. Because of its high population of Christian Arabs, Lebanon has become a linchpin for the Psalm 83 alliance. This is a key location that they can work with. So to see Europe responding so quickly, I think, shows the emphasis on Lebanon. I think it also shows the emphasis on Cyprus, and that, okay, we cannot risk, like, they did not wait long at all. Other countries, it felt like you had to have real hardship before Europe stepped in there to offer a few billion to try and solve the problem. They stepped in very quick with Cyprus. So their eyes are on Cyprus, their eyes are on Lebanon. Both of these countries are key stepping points for Europe to get more involved within the Middle East. And so they worked very quickly on this.
So that article was Why You Need to Watch Lebanon at thetrumpet.com, and it's from 2014. So we've been covering these things and watching them closely and watching for them to trend in a certain direction, to end in a certain destination for, in the case of that article, more than a decade. Why You Need to Watch Lebanon at thetrumpet.com. At thetrumpet.com, you can also get the latest issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet print magazine, as Mr. Palmer mentioned there, and get your own subscription ahead of the next issue coming out. We're working on that as we speak. That will go to the printer, I think, a week from Thursday. You'll have time to get that in your mailbox if you sign up at thetrumpet.com/subscribe. And check the show notes for the booklets and books that we've mentioned here on the program. The United States and Britain Prophecy, The King of the South, the various articles. We'll have those links handy for you. That's all the time we have for Trumpet Hour this week. Email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, Mihailo Zekic, and Andrew Miller, even though he wasn't able to be with us today, as well as Isaac Lorenz, who's pulling double duty, probably triple duty. Whenever we have issues, we just dump it on Isaac, and he handles it really well. So thanks to Isaac. And we thank you most of all for listening to the Week in Review here on Trumpet Hour. We look forward to being back with you next week.